Today's Open Journal, Myths and Madness, Iraq, is brought to you by the Houston Coalition for Justice, Not War. My name is Bob Bitter, and I'm joined in the studio today with Diane Bolanowski.
As the Bush administration escalates plans for a massive military onslaught against Iraq, activists from across the country and in Baghdad are undertaking fasts to call for an end to sanctions and oppose a new war. We spoke with Kathy Kelly, who is participating in the 40-day fast, which began on August 2nd. Kathy is co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to bring activists into Iraq to bear witness to the effect of the U.S.-UN-imposed sanctions and openly defy them by taking medical relief and supplies directly to Iraqi children. Hi, Kathy. How are you doing?
Hello, Diane. I'm good, thank you.
Good. Can you tell our listeners why you're engaging in this fast?
Well, right now I'm on a break in Chicago, having gone up to Minneapolis, still fasting. But normally I'm with a group that's parked on milk crates across from the U.S. mission to the U.N. and also across from the U.N. headquarters, where we're fasting from all solid food and wanting to more or less push a theme across the street of break ranks, build bridges. We want United Nations officials, member embassies to the United Nations workers, all of them to consider breaking ranks with policies toward Iraq, which we believe are clearly in violation of international law, that violates the UN Charter itself, violates the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children. And most assuredly, right now, we want them to join us in opposing a new war. There's not even minimal evidence to justify a new unilateral massive attack by the United States on Iraq. We sense that there's an energy in the country right now, in many places, even including coming out of the office of Representative Dick Armey, to seriously challenge President Bush's leaks and counter-leaks that were given to various media regarding an impending war against Iraq. We're really hopeful that this time of dropping out of business as usual, as you might say, by engaging in the fast might be a time when many other people want to drop out of the mainstream approach that seems to say, well, war is inevitable.
George Bernard Shaw once said that the worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. What, in your view, has been the cost of the world's indifference to the unspeakable suffering of the people of Iraq?
Well, we've lost hundreds and thousands of little children's lives, children who could have perhaps grown up to be very, very talented contributors to the world scene, children whose beauty, no matter what they did, is unquestionable, their preciousness of value to all of us. So that's a huge and a tragic loss. We've, by our indifference, I think, lost standing in the eyes of other people in the world who look at us and wonder, can it be that people in the wealthiest country in the world, this powerful country, are willing to shrug their shoulders when child sacrifice is being practiced, when there's been a slaughter of innocents?
Can you comment on the irony of a UN agency which administers a controlled starvation program?
Well, I never thought that I would see in my adult life a time when the United Nations itself would be used as an instrument to wage warfare against children. It seems utterly unthinkable. And yet, that's what's been happening. I think it's because of intense manipulation by the United States and often supported by the United Kingdom on the Security Council. We've seen a warping and a corruption of the United Nations. Not to say that we should give up on the United Nations, given the weapon proliferation that now exists all over the world and given the reliance on threat and brute force and coercion that many countries have enforced, including this country. I don't think we're in any position to say that we don't want the political machinery in place to resolve disputes nonviolently, but that machinery gets undermined every time the United States decides that it's just simply not going to abide by a treaty or a protocol or isn't going to allow for inclusion of the input of other members of the General Assembly.
Iraq now has a mortality rate of over 200 people per day. You were in Iraq as recently as June of this year. Can you describe your most recent impression of the effects that the United States and UN-imposed sanctions continues to have on the Iraqi people?
Well, I suppose one of the bleakest moments was going to a neighborhood called Jumuria. It's the poorest neighborhood in southern Basra, the southern port city that's been so hard hit by the effects of the Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf War, and now 12 years of sanctions. And I went to the family that I first go to, a family I've grown very close to. They have a very desperate situation, really. I've never known them to have any cash in which to buy anything beyond the most basic food needs, and that not enough. And Abu Muhammad, the father, said through a translator very clearly to me, "Kathy, you know, we regard you as our sister, even as almost a mother to our children, but you can see, look around you, nothing has changed. All these visits, why do you do these visits when you can see it makes no difference?" And that felt pretty disheartened, really. He was being truthful. He was being honest. There's no change in their lives. And so people are feeling beleaguered, frustrated, guilty, resentful, impotent to make any difference, and without hope. And, you know, I think I've just listed all the symptoms of classical severe depression. Mm-hmm. And when you hear sometimes American military people talk about waging psychological operations against Iraqi civilians to demoralize them, I think, well, is this the battle trophy? This family sitting in a hovel without electricity for many hours of the day in cold months, unable to manage a space heater, living on lentils and rice and lentils, with contaminated water, with their kids unable to go to school, and their children wearing the same clothes I saw them wear day in and day out for the past 3 years.
Kathy, is it a violation of law to travel to Iraq?
To travel to Iraq is a violation of U.S. law codes, and for that we're threatened with 12 years in prison, a $1 million fine, and a $250,000 administrative penalty. Two of our members were recently each penalized $10,000. We have no idea why the fine was imposed on Bert Sachs and Randall Mullins of Seattle, Washington, but we were very gratified because they said that they wouldn't pay the fine, they'd instead try to seek equivalent amounts to send over to Iraq for more food and more medicine. I'm sorry, for more medicine. We don't bring food. And within 6 days' time, we had raised the $10,000 to cover Bert Sachs' so-called fine, which was then used to help children who are battling dysentery in a clinic in Basra. And also, with our last delegation, several thousand dollars worth of anti-cancer medicines were sent.
During the Gulf War, Allied forces intentionally targeted Iraq's civilian infrastructure, including power, water, sanitation, and transportation systems. One of the stated intentions of the Iraq peace team is we will use our presence and nonviolent actions to protect, if we can, both the civilian population of Iraq and those facilities which make daily life possible for the Iraqi people. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of protecting these facilities?
Well, on January 22, 1991, the Defense Intelligence Agency issued a report. Now, mind you, this was just 7 days after the war had started. And it told in 38 very clear and really chilling paragraphs how just 6 more months of economic sanctions and Iraq's water treatment facilities would be thoroughly devastated. And it then goes out to enumerate the diseases that would be become possibly epidemic, but would certainly break out: typhus, cholera, dysentery, diarrhea. And so we're very, very aware that when so-called smart bombs or precision bombs hit electrical facilities and sewage and sanitation facilities, this causes civilian death because people can't get clean water. And so we want to be there with people, and we want to hope certainly that our presence might make some military planners wonder, should we really hit these?
Since 1991, there has been an alarming rate of deformed infants born without brains, arms, legs, or eyes. There has also been an increase in the number of children suffering from cancer, especially leukemia, in the past few years. Kathy, can you tell us what your experience has been with this? Have you witnessed any of the effects of the DU that American troops used during the Gulf War?
Doctors, you know, trying to figure out why is there a, sometimes a fivefold rise in the incidence of childhood cancers have, I think, rightly begun to wonder, is it directly related to the depleted uranium that was used during the Gulf War? and likewise with congenital deformities. And yes, I was in a Baghdad hospital one day when four children were born within one day, all of whom had congenital deformities, and I went and visited each of those cases, and it wasn't likely that the children would survive. The deformities were so severe. I've been in hospitals in Basra where wards are filled with children who have cancer who have next to no hope of surviving, and likewise at the main teaching hospital in Baghdad.
Iraq once had premier hospitals. What is your impression of the level of health care in Iraq now?
Well, it's certainly not as disastrously awful as it was when we first began to go in 1996. You do see cosmetic changes in hospitals, for instance. You'll see sheets on beds and fresh coats of paint, and there are more cleaning supplies, so the stench isn't so awful, and the elevators tend to work, and there is more equipment. But, for instance, in a hospital that was remarkably, in its appearance, better than those that I'd seen in the capital in Baghdad when I was in Mosul at a hospital there, I was all set to start writing down, oh, big improvements, and then I would still see the charts at the patient's bedsides, and the doctors would look very glum and point to the capital letters N-A, not available. And though they had many more medicines, they still would be lacking in a particular medicine which would be needed as part of a regimen to cure a child with a serious and chronic disease. I saw a kidney dialysis unit, but there were no filters. I saw a cardiac care unit, but it only had two monitors for the entire unit. I talked to residents who said that it's like oral tradition. They learn about how to become doctors from doctors who can remember having worked with the proper machines and equipment. But all of them feel like used-up doctors, in a sense, because they know that they haven't kept a pace with the fields in medicine. And then, industrial tanks being used for oxygen tanks, and still there will be an appalling lack of necessary equipment, like a centrifugal machine that's needed for blood work. You'll walk into a ward, and still doctors don't have third-generation antibiotics so desperately needed in order to help kids combat infections incurred while they're recovering with chemotherapy from cancer. And, you find out that some problem has been solved, and then 2 years later you go back and it's returned again. And so you still find children who have very bad immunities because their nutrition rate is low, and they either get respiratory diseases or they get waterborne diseases, and they can't battle against them, and so they lose. And so, no, the statistics haven't turned around in a way that would bode for a hopeful future for Iraqi children.
Psychologists refer to the children of Iraq as one of the most traumatized populations on Earth as a result of the Gulf War. In some psychological surveys, up to 80% of children thought they would not live to grow up. We spoke with Dr. Bill Thompson, who is a clinical psychologist in private practice and a member of the psychology faculty at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, where he teaches a course in nonviolence and violence. Bill has been intimately involved in the process of ending sanctions against the Iraqi people and was involved in the formation of the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. Bill has traveled to Iraq twice to directly witness the effects of the U.S.-UN sanctions policy and has also been involved in several projects to alleviate the medical and psychological suffering of the Iraqi people, particularly children. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Diane.
Hi. Well, you helped to draft the Declaration of Conscience as part of the campaign to end the sanctions in Iraq.
Yes.
It is stated in the declaration that you believe that the current sanctions policy, which has killed well over a million Iraqi people, constitutes genocide. Can you elaborate on this?
We're killing enormous numbers of people there, and it actually fits, I'm not an attorney, but according to Ramsey Clark, former attorney general, it fits the legal definition of genocide. And people like Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, who are former coordinators for the Oil for Food program in Iraq, also refer to it as genocide. So we have a situation where hundreds of thousands of people are dying as a result of our policy in order to affect some sort of political change. And that is the essence, as I understand it, of what constitutes genocide.
According to the World Health Organization, over 5,000 children under 5 die each month in Iraq from the effects produced by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Children die from easily treatable conditions such as diarrhea, dehydration. Over 30% of Iraq's children under 5 are chronically or acutely malnourished. Can you tell us how malnutrition affects a child's mental capabilities? And if perpetually malnourished children will be mentally stunted for the rest of their lives?
I'm not a physician, but just from what I know from a psychological perspective, as a child develops and neurons and neuronal pathways are formed in the central nervous system, nutrition is very important in that. Of course, it's more important the younger you are. So if you have children, especially infants, that are being malnourished, it's bound to have an effect not only on their physical growth, but on the growth of their central nervous system as well, which, of course, affects intelligence, emotions, and so on.
What has been the psychological effect of the aerial bombardment of the Gulf War and the perpetual bombardment of the last decade on the children of Iraq?
What we have in Iraq and other places in the Middle East, like Palestine, for example, is a case of continuing traumatization and re-traumatization. There's no relief. It's not as if the source of the trauma ever ends. And that, in my way of thinking, has to have an even more profound and dramatic effect on what these kids are going to be like as kids, and especially what they're going to be like as they grow up, if they grow up. There have been cases in Iraq, for example, of adults dying, healthy adults dying of what appears to be something very close to failure to thrive syndrome in infants, and it comes from the continuing kind of bombardment. It's not so much the bombardment as the continuing sanctions policy, which leads to restrictions in virtually everything. I mean, there's no hope there, and you can see it in the looks in the faces of the adults there, as well as in the children. Children, in a sense, are much more resilient than adults. When you get to a certain age and you realize that this is hopeless and it's been hopeless for a dozen years, is this ever going to change? That has a very profound effect on you. And then as kids see their parents or their aunts or their uncles or other people around them, reflecting this kind of traumatization, that can be a traumatizing stimulus in and of itself.
I met little Naira, who could not drink, in the searing heat of Baghdad. She used to offer her special friend, from whom she was inseparable, water from her little container before she drank herself, a traditional Iraqi gesture. Her friend was killed in the bombing. On a later visit, I met Ali, whose father was killed in the Gulf War. His body was returned home. Ali went to the funeral. He was 3 years old. The graveyard was near his home. Every day for 3 years, Ali ran repeatedly to the grave and dug at it with his small hand, saying, "It's all right, Daddy, you can come out now. The men who put you there have gone away." I have read that sometimes children collect pieces of shrapnel and radioactive missiles in Iraq. Why do they do this? And is this a common thing for children to do who have grown up in an environment of war and perpetual violence?
Well, I've seen a lot of that activity both in Iraq and in the West Bank and Gaza, where kids all have, and sometimes adults too, have their collections of armaments. I think it's a way of, maybe making the armaments seem less harmful. I mean, here they are spent, and therefore of no immediate danger. Of course, the armaments that have are associated with depleted uranium are very dangerous. Potentially, but what you're describing is a situation which is not at all uncommon in that part of the world, or I suspect in other parts of the world too, where these kinds of events occur.
Mm-hmm. Psychologists who study children growing up in war zones have reported that what they have described as a unique phenomenon. Many children in Iraq no longer played games. They reminded them of the dead friends that used to play with them. Can you comment on this?
A number of things to note about the kids there. First of all, they're intrigued by foreigners, and particularly Americans. If you pull out a camera, you will be immediately surrounded by 20 or 30 kids. They're very friendly. They're very playful at times, but But there's also a sense about them that there is just nothing much positive in their lives. One striking thing that I noticed is I would, you know, ask their names and how old they were, and I would always be underestimating the age of the kids because of the stunting of their growth. So I would think somebody was maybe a 10 or 11. They were 13, 14, 15 years mm-hmm. old. So this kind of emotional stunting and mental stunting and physical stunting, all of this is the result of this horrible sanctions policy that we've imposed on these people for a dozen years now. Because I know these kids are almost all dead now, and they're dying of very common kind of illnesses, things like dehydration. I mean, they can't get a saline solution. It's just absolutely tragic. There's no blood. There's very limited antibiotics, and those that exist, generally the physicians will distribute them on an equal basis. And of course, antibiotics need to be taken in a pretty heavy continuous dosage, and so they're ineffective for anybody. It's not that the doctors don't know that that's not going to work, but that they don't want to be put in the position of essentially deciding who's going to live and who's going to die. But going through those hospitals is an experience unlike anything I've ever experienced in the past, and I certainly hope I never have to see something like that again, although I do anticipate I will in going back to Iraq.
The U.S. used nuclear weapons against Iraq in 1991 in the form of highly radioactive depleted uranium, or DU. Over 4,000 U.S. veterans entered areas contaminated by DU in Iraq. Veterans with DU fragments embedded in their bodies have shown severe symptoms, including cancerous tumors. World-renowned surgeon Dr. Jinan Ali has been keeping a record of mysterious congenital abnormalities which have been seen in Iraq. Her photographs from 1998 are chilling. Full-term babies underdeveloped, babies reminiscent of those born in the nuclear testing areas of the South Pacific. A baby with no face, another with no eyes, twisted limbs or no limbs, babies born without brains. In your visit to Iraq, have you seen evidence of these extreme abnormalities and of children suffering from cancer and leukemia?
Oh, yeah, a lot of cancer and leukemia, and also a number of what appear to be congenital abnormalities. Every hospital has its photograph album, if you will, of different kids who have been born with really grotesque kinds of abnormalities, the kinds of things that we associate with thalidomide and that situation that occurred some decades ago here in the United States. So there's no question that these kind of abnormalities have increased. There's no question that they could well be related to the DU situation. I personally think that's extraordinarily likely that that's the case. And you can't go in and do the kind of research and so forth that you need to do to absolutely pin that down. But for that matter, we don't know the source of Gulf War syndrome that a number of the soldiers, American soldiers and other soldiers from the coalition have suffered from. We don't know the origins of that either. But again, it could very well be related to the use of DU.
Has the UN and the world broken its promise to the children of Iraq?
Absolutely. You know, I read the Convention of the Child, and I think not just in Iraq, but in Palestine, in the United States, I mean, we're really not doing what we need to be doing for children everywhere in the world. And it's absolutely tragic. And it's especially tragic when you have the large numbers of children in Iraq that are being affected in this negative way. It's a very dangerous situation, not just for the children themselves, but those children that survive this system and grow up, what are they going to be like? What are their attitudes going to be toward the United States? Are they going to be the same kind of individuals who might see it as their responsibility or their duty to perform some sort of a horrible attack against the United States or citizens of the United States. And I can certainly understand, I certainly don't argue for that, but I could certainly, as a clinical psychologist, understand how that could occur.
We spoke with Bert Sachs, a Seattle engineer and activist who has traveled to Iraq with delegations from Voices in the Wilderness and the Washington-based Physicians for Social Responsibility on numerous trips to Iraq since 1995. On May 17, 2002, the U.S. Treasury Office in charge of sanctions sent a letter to Bert Sachs, imposing a $10,000 fine on him for his admission that he brought medicines to Iraq in 1997 without a U.S. license. Hi, Bert.
Hi.
Hi. Can you tell us why you refused to pay the $10,000 fine which has been imposed on you for alleged violations of U.S. sanctions regulations?
Yes, I'm glad to. There are laws which I consider to be wrong laws, laws that shouldn't be obeyed. A law which tells American citizens when they may bring medicines to help people in need is such a law. Under what conditions, I ask the federal government, would it ever be possible, permissible, for them to deny me the right to bring medicine?
I understand that you displayed samples of the types of medicines which you brought to Iraq at the press conference. Can you tell us what some of these medicines were and what types of treatments they are used for?
Yes, I remember specifically going to Basra, which is the large city in the south, most badly hit by the Gulf War and the previous Iran-Iraq War. And we brought down there, I can remember clearly, a big container, the jar of antibiotics pills. And the pharmacist who accepted that, working with the Chaldean church, was so happy to receive that. He knew what we knew, which is it was going to save many dozens or hundreds of children's lives. The prime killer of children is diarrhea, is waterborne diseases. So we brought down the medicines to try and help alleviate that, even though the cure of the problem has to be the tens of billions of dollars necessary to repair the infrastructure. We mostly try and bring children's medicines because half the deaths are children under five. They're the most vulnerable, along with the very elderly and weak, and it's so wrong to target them.
Are U.S. sanction laws a violation of international humanitarian law and illegal under the U.S. Constitution?
I believe they are. I'm agreed with by other professors such as Richard Falk of Princeton University. Francis Boyle is the University of Illinois Law School. There's also a very good op-ed piece printed here in the Seattle newspaper, the PI, by a professor of law at University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco, titled Sanctions is Genocide. Not only are sanctions, quote, unequivocally illegal under international humanitarian law, end quote, they may also be genocide. That quote actually comes from the United Nations Subcommission on Human Rights, which found that the sanctions as we apply them on Iraq, I'm not opposed to all sanctions and not military sanctions for sure, but the sanctions as we've applied them on Iraq after destroying their infrastructure, I contend are a very, very grave violation of international law and the human rights of the civilian population of Iraq. Yes.
You have said that sanctions represent dropping one slow-motion Hiroshima bomb on Iraq every year. Can you elaborate on this statement?
Yes. In the 12 years now since the sanctions have been in place, if you say, taking the middle estimate of 600,000 deaths, children only, children, you find that we're talking about 50,000 deaths of children and probably 50,000 deaths of people over the age of five every year. If you compare that with the number of people that died at Hiroshima, you can see this is not an exaggeration. It's really virtually a literal description of what is happening. Only because it's happening out of sight, because it's happening in the hospitals and in the homes of these bereaved parents who are loving their children no less than we do, it's unseen by us. It's become the effective, skillfully effective, in quotes here, way to apply pressure on a civilian population that would be completely unacceptable and impossible if you saw it in terms of dropping bombs and killing the same number of children, or even a fraction of that.
Where then does the criminal liability rest?
Leave out the word criminal for just a moment and say that liability or responsibility is maybe a better word, rests with all of us. I think it's not simply helpful, good, to point the finger and blame and demonize people in Washington or the Treasury Department or the Pentagon. All of us have an obligation to speak about this, to read what is the public record, and to try and talk to everybody we can. Talk to neighbors, talk to newspaper editors, as we did just yesterday. I think the direct criminal responsibility, to go back to that word, has to lie with the groups of people that actually did the planning, the determination that it would be all right. It would be a way to have, quote, long-term leverage on the government of Iraq by doing this bombing. The Pentagon planners, on the one hand, and then the people, I think, in the State Department that decided to continue the sanctions as a tool of leverage afterwards, as they increasingly came to realize the lethal consequences of that. Is it acceptable for one country to apply lethal means to the civilian population of another to coerce it? That is, in fact, a crime, even on our books. And we are not only using lethal coercion for an officially, quote, acceptable goal from the UN of disarmament, we're using it for a completely unauthorized goal in terms of international law, the goal of regime change. And the consequences have been deadly.
Colin Powell, during his confirmation hearings for Secretary of State, stated, "No one cares more for the children of Iraq more than I do."
Yes. Well, if that's the case, how can you continue to justify a policy which has been so demonstrably, so powerfully argued against by the people who have no political axe to grind, who have no desire to coerce, who are simply reporting the facts, such as the New England Journal of Medicine or Representative Tony Hall or the UN Subcommission on Human Rights, or most powerfully by the two men who were there sent to administer the humanitarian aid program, who both, the first two, resigned their positions to protest what we're doing. How can Colin Powell say such a thing, having it convey any genuine meaning beyond being a useful soundbite for our television? It's shocking. The prime cause of the waterborne diseases that are occurring in Iraq is the destruction of Iraq's civilian infrastructure. Without question, the Pentagon targeted virtually all the electrical generating plants in Iraq. Was significantly destroyed or damaged after the Gulf War, which meant that in the central and southern regions, which is a very flat part of the country, you need electricity to pump water. You need electricity to process sewage. You also need electricity to refrigerate medicines. And when you shut off all of those things, it's not simply an inconvenience. It is the cause of the failure to produce in a largely urbanized country the safe drinking water that people in the cities need. Basra is over 1 million people, Baghdad 6 million. You shut off electricity, you shut off the safe water. You also shut off, by the way, the incubators in all the hospitals. People may remember the story, the false story, actually, of babies being allegedly taken from incubators in Kuwait by Iraqi soldiers, a story fabricated by Hill & Knowlton, the public relations firm, that was very convincing to the American public. Well, where is the story about all the incubators that we unplugged by destroying the electrical plants? What sadness, what tragedy to do that. And the waterborne diseases are the major contributor 12 years later, 11 years later, to the deaths going on in that country.
After returning from your eighth trip to Iraq in May of this year, can you tell us what progress has been made in the repair of the infrastructure? And what improvements, if any, did you note in the overall daily living conditions of average Iraqis?
This trip in Baghdad, slight improvement because of the Oil for Food program. Something like $500 million has gotten into the country for, I believe, the electrical sector or the water and sewage sector. And that may sound impressive, but Compared to the needs, which are in the tens of billions of dollars to repair the basic infrastructure, numbers from 20 billion to 100 billion, it's a drop in the bucket. And basically, the whole system is barely being held together by cannibalizing old parts and doing repairs that you should not do, I was told by UNICEF in the electrical sector, that are dangerous to the lives of the workers there, just to keep things going. All of that's very relevant to the threat of further war on Iraq, which, if it were to disrupt this tenuous life support system, the electrical water systems, and the food distribution system, which is really just what's keeping so many people still on the edge of starvation, really. It's keeping them above that edge. If that were disrupted by a war of any length or by of any destructive power to the infrastructure again, we could easily have 50,000 more children die in just 8 months. If we go to war and do it even anything approaching the way we did it in 1991, I am very fearful of what conditions we would create and then remain oblivious to, given the large failure of our media to report this and the manipulation of the media by our government and military sources of how many deaths would occur to children and to elderly and those in need of this care in the days and months following any military action against Iraq.
I heard a couple years ago an interview with President Clinton and Amy Goodman. Clinton told her that under the Food for Oil program, that Saddam's oil revenues had actually increased compared to prior to the Gulf War, and placed much of the suffering and blame at his feet. I know there's numerous reports I've seen in the media, and I think it's what most Americans think is the reality, is that he's diverting supplies and hoarding supplies and contributing to the suffering of his own people. Now, what has the United Nations observers found there?
Thank you for asking that question. There are several key points that need to be understood that most Americans don't know when they hear the All for Food program. The first one is, in that time when President Clinton quoted the amount of oil that was sold, he quoted it in dollars, and the price of oil at that time was very high. But whatever the price of oil is, if you take off the amounts of money that actually reach Baghdad that are available to deal with the needs of the citizens in the country, that is, if you take off what most of the time has been 30%, is now 25% of that revenue for war reparations, which go to major corporations, Kuwaiti oil, $16 billion, while children are lacking in food. Take that off. Take off 13%, which goes with a cash component to the Kurdish population in the north, which none of the war reparations comes out of their share. And then take off another about 5% for the operation of UNSCOM and the weapons inspectors, even with no inspections now, that's still being taken out and is used to pay the Office of Iraq Program staff and other expenses, plus the people, the 1,500 people who are the inspectors in Iraq to make sure the program works fairly in the south and central regions. You take all of that off, you're left with just a bit more than 50% of the money for 20 million people. Over the 5 years from 96 to 2001, when the numbers are available quite definitely from the UN, the total amount of money that was actually came into the country available in the south central region for each citizen of that country was $119.70. $120 a year per person, 33 cents a day. Now, can anyone live on that, realizing it's not simply the needs for food and medicine for each individual, it's the needs for electricity and water and sewage and education and transportation, all of the needs of a person? Given the fact that this is not aid coming from someone else, it's Iraq's own money being spent to meet the needs of their own citizens. Given that fact, what has been the justification ever for limiting Iraq to how much money it can spend for its own citizens' needs, when every dollar of that is completely controlled in a bank account, controlled completely by the UN, and money can be taken out only for these needs? I think that is the second piece of evidence of our intention to have punitive measures applied against the people of Iraq for the purpose of coercion, for whatever goal. That is just wrong.
The approval process for supply contracts, I understand that the United States blocked many of these, stating dual use, such things as water purification chemicals, chlorinators. Can you tell us something about this process and why these materials aren't getting into Iraq through the sanctions program?
Yes. The name of the committee, which has the power to block any of those items ordered, up until the resolution from the Security Council that passed in May of this year, called 1409, which is our supposed smart sanctions, which I'll talk about in just a minute, up until that time, so for all of the history of the Oil for Food program from 96 until this past May, had a committee called the 661 Committee, named after the original Security Council resolution that created this, which consisted of the 15 members of the Security Council. And it was created in such a way that any member of that committee had the power, all by his or herself, to block any item, any contract. Given that, the United States has been, I think, over 90% of the time the country which has blocked items. And we actually boast of that fact. The classic case of what has been blocked as dual-use item is pencils. Pencils, for different reasons, and I can't think of any legitimate reason why pencils should be blocked as a dual-use item, except, sadly, I think a lot of this has been done to punish the people, and there's no recourse to this. Well, the reputation of that committee in the United States blocking of items, which had reached $5 billion recently, terms of blocked items, which have included all kind of essential components like pumps that could conceivably have some possible dual-use item, but could be monitored by these 1,500 inspectors that are there as finally chlorine was allowed to be done so that water can begin to be purified in Iraq. Those amounts of monies and goods that are essential were blocked have had a terribly disruptive effect on what gets into Iraq that can be used. There's one other mention of that before I talk about smart sanctions, which is important to know. It's the issue that's called complementarity. What that means is if you have a whole series of, for example, cancer drugs or medical equipment, and you block one component of that, all the rest can get in, but the rest are either much less effective or sometimes completely useless. For example, surgical equipment, if you block one item that's needed for surgery, you may not be able to do any of the surgery. I recall reading medicines being allowed in, but surgical soap being blocked because that wasn't medicine. Well, how do doctors wash their hands? Maybe there's some ways around it, but that's an example. In response, the U.S. and the U.K. have come up with a notion which has been called smart sanctions, without saying what that implies about the previous sanctions regime. A resolution was passed called 1409 in the Security Council, which created a modified regime in which items were to be allowed to go into Iraq that didn't appear on a 300-some-odd page book of restricted items. But again, 300 pages of items that are restricted, and what falls in that book and how do you interpret that is just an ongoing problem to try and shift the blame away from the U.S. and U.K.'s blocking of items on the Security Council. But if the U.S. especially controls the committees, as we have so much done, and suborns the proper operation of UN organizations like this committee, like the War Reparations Committee, and like UNSCOM, the weapons inspectors, if we do that, then there is good reason for people, not just in Iraq and not just in the Arab countries, but around the world, to look very askance at how the U.S. is using institutions within the UN for their own agendas, for our own agenda. And the agenda of regime change, for which there is no authorization at all.
And one thing I wonder is if you could give our listeners some of your thoughts on a workable solution to this situation.
Mm-hmm. In the process of working on this issue for 8 years, I've come to think more and more that the most important, practical, down-to-earth, realpolitik change that has to take place in order to find a non-military solution and a successful and happy resolution to this has to do, to begin with our attitudes. And in particular, the attitude that we've cultivated for so many years, which is demonization of one man, is, I think, probably the major obstacle for resolving the situation without going to war. In short, we've painted ourselves into a corner by imagining that this man, who has done many, many bad things, Saddam Hussein, is clearly a very bad human rights record, and we try and speak of it whenever we have an opportunity with Iraqi officials. Still, there are plenty of people that we supported, including Saddam Hussein. And the solution, I think, is clearly to have weapons inspectors go back into Iraq and to verify whether or not there are production facilities to make those weapons. Here's a government that isn't so eager to have the weapons inspectors come in unless they have some assurance, both that if the process is completed within time limits, so that this process can't go on forever, and done independently without targeting of the leadership of that country, then I think we could easily have weapons inspectors back in Iraq, a timetable set for their process, and we can verify whether or not Iraq's claim that they don't have any weapons available anymore can be accomplished. And that would resolve this whole issue.
We had the opportunity to speak with historian and playwright Howard Zinn, who was active in the civil rights movement and in the movement against the Vietnam War. He has written numerous books, including A People's History of the United States and Terrorism and War.
That the punishment of a citizen for engaging in a humanitarian act, bringing medicine to people in desperate need, should not be accepted in a society claiming to believe in justice. To disobey a law when that law violates a fundamental human right is part of the American democratic tradition. We now honor those who, before the Civil War, disobeyed the Fugitive Slave Act and helped black people escape from slavery. We honor those black people in the South who disobeyed the law in order to protest against racial segregation. The right to food and medicine is something guaranteed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt helped frame in 1948, and to which our nation is a signatory. Any law or regulation which eliminates that right does not deserve to be obeyed. And those today who bring food and medicine to people in need should be honored, not punished.
At a time when our country is purportedly waging a war on terrorism, isn't it true that the war that the United States has been waging against the Iraqi people for the last 12 years and the acceleration of that war that the Bush administration is threatening is in fact state-sponsored terrorism?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you broaden the definition of terrorism, because if you maintain a narrow definition, then you can apply that definition only to the people who are doing something to you. You know, if you define terrorism narrowly as, you know, people who will kill a lot of innocent people for whatever end they have in mind, that is, in other words, what happened on September 11th, well, that is terrorism, of course. It's one definition of terrorism. But I think that terrorism should be defined more broadly, and it should include the waging of any war or the carrying out of any policy which results in the death of a very large number of people. And that certainly applies to our sanctions against Iraq, which have been going on for 10 years, which have denied them food, medicine, basic water, medical facilities, electrical facilities needed for hospitals. The result being, as the United Nations has reported, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children. Now, that is a humanitarian disaster. That is the result of a deliberate policy on the part of the United States and other nations that have supported the sanctions. And so, by my broader definition of terrorism, that policy of sanctions certainly fits the definition of terrorism. Yes, it's state terrorism as opposed to the terrorism of individuals or groups, but it's terrorism nonetheless.
Defense intelligence documents prove beyond a doubt that the United States government intentionally targeted the civilian infrastructure of Iraq. How then does this redefine the meaning of collateral damage?
Well, you know, the definition of collateral damage is, you know, is very, very interesting, because it suggests, you know, that, well, you know, this is damage that occurred that we didn't really intend, but it accompanied something that we did intend. Now, the truth is that whenever you drop bombs from a high altitude, you are inevitably going to kill innocent people, inevitably. I mean, I say this as a former bombardier in the Air Force. And if you know that the deaths of innocent people are inevitable, then your dropping of bombs sort of is a deliberate act, and you cannot escape its consequences, its moral consequences. You cannot escape the guilt of committing that immoral act by saying, oh, you know, that's collateral damage. We didn't intend it. But it's as if you were, you know, driving a car at 80 miles an hour down a street crowded with children, and children are killed, and you say, well, the deaths of the children were collateral damage. I was just trying to get somewhere. No, that cannot be morally accepted. And, you know, the whole notion of military targets also needs to be looked at without accepting the definitions given by the Pentagon or other officials of the United States government. Remember that even the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which obviously destroying an entire city, killed huge numbers of innocent people, even that was referred to by President Truman as, well, we deliberately chose a military target. Well, that gives you an idea of how broad is the definition of military target. During the Gulf War, in the middle of February 1991, the United States dropped a bomb on an air raid shelter in Baghdad, an air raid shelter in which men, women, children were huddled against the bombs. But they deliberately dropped a bomb on that air raid shelter. 400, 500 people were killed. It was, you know, an atrocity. And what did the United States government say? They said, well, it was a military target because there was electronic equipment in that air raid shelter. Now, reporters going through the wreckage immediately after said they saw absolutely no sign of any electronic equipment. The United States was lying. It's very important for citizens to understand that governments lie, especially in wartime, because in wartime, governments are always committing atrocities and always trying to cover that up by not telling the truth to people. So whenever we hear the government say we're only bombing military targets, we should look at it with an enormous amount of skepticism. Anybody who remembers the war in Vietnam and how often the United States government said, oh, we're only bombing military targets in Vietnam. And, you know, by the end, a million civilians were killed in Vietnam. And the fact is, and I say this as somebody who visited Vietnam during the war and saw villages that had been bombed, villages nowhere near any military target, just peasant villages bombed deliberately by jet aircraft coming over in the middle of the night We have a long history of bombing civilians. No country since World War II has such a deadly story to tell about what we have done. And so for us to sort of put aside the killing of people as collateral damage, or to claim we're only bombing military targets, you know, is absolute hypocrisy.
Since the Gulf War began, Saddam Hussein and his regime have survived 12 years as the Iraqi people have perished. To repeat an attack on this defenseless people with no rationale for a war is not only cruel, but exposes the fact that other reasons are behind the effort. In your view, what are some of the more honest reasons?
Well, the real reason, I believe, for an attack on Iraq is to find a regime that will be friendly to the United States, and that will make sure the United States has the control of oil that the United States has always wanted. Behind American policy in the Middle East ever since World War II has been the desire to control the oil of the Middle East. The real problem with Saddam Hussein is not that he's a tyrant. He is, of course. But we have put up with many tyrants. In fact, we have put tyrants in power. We have given military equipment to tyrants. We gave, in fact, we supported Saddam Hussein, until 1990, 1991. So the idea that we're going to war just because we want to get rid of a tyrant simply doesn't stand up. We want to control the oil of the Middle East. We like to have governments that will do what we say, and not governments that are independent of us. We've shown this again and again. We overthrew a government in Iran in 1953. It wasn't a tyrannical government, but it was a government that had nationalized the oil supplies, and so we orchestrated an overthrow of that regime. In 1954, we planned an invasion of Guatemala to overthrow the government of Guatemala. Now, why? Was Guatemala run by a tyrant? No. It was run by a democratically elected president, but he had confiscated the land of the United Fruit Company. And this won't go because the United Fruit Company had close ties with the American government. So you always have to look behind the claims of the government when it says this is why we're going to war and look for the real reasons. I believe the real reasons have to do with oil. They have to do with establishing more military bases in the Middle East that we can control. I believe it also has to do with politics, and it has to do with the building of the American military and the military budget, which create enormous profits for corporations that build jet aircraft, nuclear weapons, attack submarines. I think these are the real reasons. Those reasons have nothing to do with human rights. They have nothing to do with fighting against tyranny. And there's no guarantee that Saddam Hussein won't be replaced by another tyrant. And we will go to war. If we go to war against Iraq, we will be killing, again, a lot of innocent people. And for no good reason except power and profit.
Mr. Zinn, there are people who may oppose an escalation of the war on Iraq, but feel powerless to effect a change. What would you say to those people?
Well, you know, I understand the feeling of powerlessness. We all feel it. There's the power of the United States government, which is enormous, and a power which is increasing every day as they take away our civil liberties. But we ought to keep in mind that historically, people who felt powerless but who began to protest and who had the right on their side, their numbers grew. Small movements became larger movements because more and more people saw what was right and what was wrong. That's what happened in the civil rights movement in the South. The black people in the South were powerless. And when small numbers of them began to protest, sat in freedom rides, demonstrated, they looked as if they could never accomplish anything. They did not have enough power against the power of the white South and of the United States government, which is really standing by and collaborating with the South. But that movement grew and grew and grew until it could not be resisted, until finally it won. Same thing happened with the movement against the war in Vietnam. Started with small groups of people feeling powerless, against the might of the United States, and because the movement basically against the war was right and could tell the truth, and when people, I believe, see the truth, finally, after being lied to, they see what's right, they see what's wrong, and then they come around, they change their minds, they join movements, and soon that tiny anti-war movement became a nationwide movement. That tiny movement for civil rights in the South became a nationwide movement. And so it takes everybody pitching in, joining local organizations, doing everything you can. If everybody in the country just begins to act, begins to speak out, begins to organize, that at some point all those thousands of little acts will merge into some great movement which will change policy in a direction that we want this government to go, in a direction that the Declaration of Independence suggested. Now, a government that would protect the rights of people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop.